The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm producer K.O. Myers. This week we're talking about some of the most interesting things we know about the brain. Ingrid Wickelgren, editor at Scientific American Mind, joins us to tell us how our brains are wired to believe in the paranormal. But first, we'll look back at some of our favorite past episodes about the brain and its fascinating functions. Enjoy!
I'm here with Daniel Levitin, neuroscientist and director of the Laboratory for Music Perception and Expertise in the Department of Psychology at McGill University. He's also the author of This Is Your Brain on Music. So you point out in the book that much of what we think of as sound is really an internal process that happens in the brain.
So it's all in the brain. And it's so much so that I look at it this way. If you didn't have a brain to intercept the vibrating molecules, it wouldn't really be sound. It would just be disturbances in the atmosphere. And so, you know, the answer to Bishop Berkeley's question, the famous one we all learned as students, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? From a cognitive neuroscience standpoint, no, it doesn't. It disturbs the atmosphere. It disturbs the molecules. But sound is something that is constructed in the brain of some sentient organism, a human, a marmoset, a dog, even an insect, but with their tiny little brains. But sound is not something that's there if there's not a brain there to perceive it.
So really what happens next depends on what sounds we're hearing then.
Right. So the brain has to construct this reality of sound, again, from this wiggling, and it processes sound in components. We don't realize it, but as soon as the signal hits the brain sends it out to some specialized neural circuits. So some of these circuits figure out how loud the sound is. Different ones figure out where it's coming from. And different neural circuits from that figure out how long it lasted, what its tonal color was, you know, say what which distinguishes a trumpet from a piano. They figure out its pitch, and then it all comes together later as a complete whole object. And you go, oh, that was the opening note of Satisfaction by the Stones. But later in brain times is maybe 40,000ths of a second later. It happens so fast you don't realize that all these components are being built up and put together.
And the reaction of our brains to music differs from its reaction to speech, then.
Yeah, and that's an interesting story. It seems as though there are dedicated circuits in the brain, dedicated networks of neurons, that are selectively tuned to speech and others that are selectively tuned to music.
Well, what distinct parts of the brain are affected?
Nearly every region of the brain is affected by music, nearly every region that we know about. The obvious ones, just above your ears, maybe by coincidence, but anyway, conveniently, just above your ears is the region of the brain called the temporal lobe, and a portion of the temporal lobe we call auditory cortex, because that's the part that handles sound. Now, it's not always that way. The part that handles smell isn't just above or behind your nose, and the part that handles vision isn't anywhere near your eyes, but it works out this way with hearing. And after auditory cortex, some other areas that are involved are the frontal lobes, the parts right above your eyebrows. They're involved in trying to predict what's going to come next in either speech or music. And they're pretty good at it. So if I were to start a sentence like this, the pizza was too hot to sleep. The part of you that's surprised with what I said is the frontal lobes, because they were expecting something different than that.
Well, I'm particularly interested in the mesolimbic system, I have to say. How is that affected by music?
The limbic system is part of a network of structures that have been with our animal cousins for many, many hundreds of thousands of years. So we call the limbic system the reptilian brain sometimes, because even reptiles have a rudimentary limbic system. That's how far back it goes phylogenetically. So it includes structures like the amygdala, which are responsible for fear and for emotional reactions to things. If you hear scary music, like Bernard Herrmann's score to Psycho, the violins in the shower scene, That's the amygdala that's giving you the sweaty palms or the hair standing on end. And what we've learned in the last few years is that the amygdala and other portions of the limbic system have direct connections to sound. And one of the reasons we think that people have such strong emotional reactions to music are these connections to the mesolimbic system. It's also interesting to note that it's not just fear that's mediated by these regions, but pleasure. This is well known by the Canadian psychologists James Olds and Peter Milner. It's been long known and well known as a pleasure center. This is the part of the brain that if you put a rat in a cage and you allow it to press a bar that will stimulate its limbic system, the rat will do that and do nothing else. It won't eat, it won't sleep, it won't mate. It'll just keep stimulating that pleasure center.
Does this have something to do with like serotonin and dopamine and such?
It does. So serotonin and dopamine are two chemicals that are naturally occurring in the brain, and the brain releases them. It sends them around where needed. They're associated with the emotions and the feelings of being in a positive mood, being happy, content, and being able to focus your concentration. Now, of course, it's more subtle than that, and they interact with each other and with other chemicals. But because they're associated with mood, we now have a whole class of drugs called serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. That's Zoloft and Paxil and Prozac and the others. And it turns out that music is able to mediate the dopamine part of the system, maybe serotonin. We haven't seen that yet. But when people listen to music they like, the brain produces a squirt of dopamine, which is the same chemical that's produced when you eat chocolate, provided you like chocolate, or if you are a gambler and you win a bet, or you're a cocaine addict and you get some cocaine, or if you have a sexual experience. Dopamine is being produced in all those cases and in music.
So the other system that responds to particularly songs that we like is the cerebellum.
Yeah, now that's an interesting story. The cerebellum is a structure that, again, is common to all vertebrates. For a long, long time, we thought it just had to do with movement. So it was more like it didn't respond to the song Start Me Up, but just to continue the Stones theme. But it was the thing that started you up. It's the thing, the cerebellum was responsible for moving, for allowing you to plan and coordinate moving your legs, to go out and seek food and shelter and mating opportunities, to put it nicely. And we find in patients with Parkinson's disease, that which is a deterioration of the cerebellum, one of the symptoms is they're unable to walk or they're unable to move with smooth, continuous motion. The surprise with the cerebellum to scientists has been that it's not only related to emotion, but it's particularly related to musical emotion. And I think this is part of the key to understanding how music works its magic. I think it's because music has rhythm. It has this pulse. And pulses like that stimulate the cerebellum directly, because the cerebellum, again, is responsible for movement, coordinated movement. That's the part of you that would have you all rowing in synchrony if you were in a rowboat, or would have you running together or marching together if you were with other people. Things that were very important for our ancestors on the hunt, right? You had to move in synchrony in order to bring down some big beast. So this idea of synchronization of your movements has a very ancient evolutionary origin. The pulse of music seems to stimulate these rhythmic portions of the cerebellum, and that's one of the reasons we want to dance to it, and one of the reasons we have this emotional reaction, because the cerebellum is in turn involved in mediating emotions and motivation.
So you mentioned that the brain anticipates what the next beat will be. So is this the part of the brain that does that then?
It's not. This is not as far as we know. I have to qualify all these things because brain science is still relatively young.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems as though the cerebellum is able to keep track of, I suppose you could say it anticipates when the next beat will be. The real job of the cerebellum is to set up a kind of a clock that synchronizes with things. And so, of course, it has to predict what's going to come next. But the part that's most acutely aware of any violation of an expectation is in that prefrontal cortex we talked about earlier, just behind your eyebrows. That's the part that's surprised when you say the pizza was too hot to sleep, or is surprised if I play you a musical sequence that doesn't make sense. If you allow me, I'll demonstrate here.
I'm so excited.
So it would be a particularly normal chord progression if I were to play something like this. But that's not normal, right?
Right.
And your brain knew that. You don't know the names of the notes, probably, unless you have absolute pitch. And you may not even know the names of the chords. But when you hear... something sounds a little off. And it's a violation of your sense of what the norms are in Western music. You don't have to know music theory, but your brain is a giant prediction device, and it's spent its whole life, as it were, trying to figure out regularities in the world.
So you say in the book that our brains actually take satisfaction in being able to predict that.
Ooh, another Rolling Stones cue. Yes, the brain does get a sense of satisfaction. You could think of it as kind of like a sweet satisfaction, almost like brown sugar. And the satisfaction is because we evolved in a world where it would have been adaptive for us to learn new things about the world, where there's a new well, where we can find a new fruit tree. And so the way that the brain encourages us to do things is that it releases dopamine and gives us a feeling of pleasure, satisfaction. We like learning new things because it's adaptive for us to do so. The brain rewards us by getting that hit of, oh, that's cool. I'm glad I learned that. And we're doing this subconsciously thousands of times a day. And as children, we're hearing speech and we're hearing music. And we learn the regularities of musical forms. As children, any four-year-old can tell you that sequence I played sounded funny.
You also say, though, that the brain enjoys violations of those expectations.
Right. The reason is that if the violation is done artfully in a way that makes sense, it's teaching us something new about the world that also makes sense. I think the metaphor is I may know one route to the well, but if a friend of mine shows me there's another way to get there, I'm kind of tickled by that. And it's useful for me to know an alternate route to the water well in case a tree falls or there's an avalanche or there's a neighboring tribe blocking the access or something, right? And so if we think of music as being a route, a way to get from one chord to another, or you know, to get from the beginning of a sequence to the end of a sequence, anything a composer can do to show us there's another way to get there is interesting. There's a famous trick that McCartney uses in his songwriting that he didn't invent, but he sort of popularized as a new way to complete a musical phrase. So just to continue with the chords I was playing earlier. That's a normal kind of a sequence in popular music, right? McCartney does this. And he's done that a lot of times. We're not used to hearing that. That third chord I played is actually not in the key, but it works. And we like it because your brain is learning, oh, there's not only a different way you can get there, with there being the final resolution, but it's an interesting way that you wouldn't have predicted and wouldn't have thought of. And so that's taught you something about the world that you didn't know.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking today with Daniel Levitin, author of This Is Your Brain on Music. So does part of this have to do with the music's complexity then, or is it more just dependent on the music that the individual enjoys?
It's the latter. James Brown is going to activate the pleasure center only if you like James Brown. And, you know, Vivaldi's only going to do it if you like Vivaldi. And musical tastes are so individual and so idiosyncratic, we can't really make any hard and fast rules about what the average listener is going to have happening in their brain in response to a particular piece of music. But as I was saying, there are some sort of general rules. So the more rhythmic you find the music, as opposed to the more rhythmic the music is, the more the cerebellum's going to be activated, and the more interested you are in the lyrics, the more the analytical parts of your brain and lexical parts of your brain are going to become involved.
Well, you talk about the music that you heard in your teenage years really being the best music of all, and that there's neurological reasons for that.
Well, the music I heard in my teenage years is the best because it really was. But in the general case, all of us think that. And part of the story is hormonal, and part of it is social psychological. When we hit the pubertal growth hormones, they tend to make everything seem really important. And so it's not just the music of our early teen years that we remember. We remember our friends. We remember movies from then, books. And the way memory works is that, in general, we tend to remember the things that have the most emotional meaning to us. And all kinds of stuff from our early teen years is injected, infused with meaning, largely because of the hormones. And so we remember and like best the music, as a rule, from the ages of 12 to 16. That doesn't mean we'd stop liking music after then, but to some degree our tastes are formed then. As 40-year-olds, we don't really want to hear the music we heard when we were 15 all the time, but we want to hear music that has some of those qualities or some of those properties.
You can find Daniel Levitin at yourbrainonmusic.com.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And now back to the show.
I'm here today with Dr. Cordelia Fine. She's the author of Delusions of Gender: How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference. So before we get into modern day research, you say that scientists have actually been getting this wrong for years. So can you tell us about some of the testing methods that turned out to have nothing to do with behavioral or cognitive differences between the genders?
There are lots of examples. So there was early French philosopher, a contemporary of Descartes, who suggested that women's brain fibers were too delicate to deal with abstract thought. And that's why they weren't as good at thinking as men were. One of my favorite examples is actually the period in time when brain scientists suddenly actually got into the brain as such. They were still dealing with the outer casing, and they were quite keen on the idea that the ratio of skull breadth to skull height was a good indicator of mental capacity. So they'd go around sort of wrapping tape measures around people's heads and working out the ratio. And so you're either sort of broad-headed or long-headed. And they were very, very interested in whether this could distinguish superior groups, you know, namely white European males, from intellectually inferior groups, so, you know, people who weren't white and weren't male. And I think what's interesting about this example is the sort of theoretical contortions they had to go through to sort of, or attempted to make in order to try and keep women in an inferior group. So as the data came in, they weren't really very neat. They didn't quite fit the hypothesis. And so one of the advocates of this you know, measure of index of mental capacity, Paul Popenard, he suggested, well, perhaps women are more broad-headed in the long-headed groups, but more long-headed in the broad-headed groups. You know, he said he wanted them to be different. And, you know, in the end, of course, that was abandoned. The idea that your skull shape was an indicator of mental capacity was also abandoned, and, you know, it became more sophisticated. So then people started sort of weighing scales, so it actually got into the brain itself, and that was more sophisticated. And then, of course, the hypothesis was, as is true, that the female brain on average is smaller and lighter than the male brain. And it was very much sort of mainstream scientific opinion that this explained women's intellectual inferiority. And so this was known amongst the Victorian public as the missing 5 ounces of female brain.
Ah.
And eventually it became evident that there wasn't this neat, bigger is better correlation when it came to brain size and intelligence. And the historian of science, Cynthia Russett, describes very, very dryly and amusingly the way he thought, well, you know, people said, well, look, maybe it's just that, you know, bigger body, bigger brain, it's just part of the body relationship. So they tried to find a a relative measure of brain size that would keep men ahead. Just as they tried everything, you know, sort of weight and height and, you know, even trying to relate it to someone bone, like the femur or something, in a desperate attempt to make men come out ahead. And you know, again, this hypothesis was eventually abandoned. But, of course, there are always more to spring up and take their place. And those are the sorts of hypotheses that I look at in my book.
Cordelia, one of the things you did in your book was completely tear apart Luann Brissendine's book, The Female Brain. So let's look at just one of those claims, that the female brain is wired to empathize. So how did she come to that conclusion?
I think part of the route that she took to that conclusion, partly to present evidence that behaviorally women are superior in empathizing, but then she also looked at neuroimaging data as well. And it is quite comical reading Luann Brissendine's book, because she does paint an incredible picture of women's empathizing abilities. I mean, apparently we're actually supposed to know what men are thinking before they even know themselves, which
is quite setting
the bar pretty high, I think. And there's also, when she talks about the female brain being hardwired to sort of monitor the thoughts and feelings of other people, I mean, she's not saying explicitly, but she's very much saying that women, it is your job to take care of other people's feelings and be concerned about them and be the one who notices when someone's upset and so on and so forth. So, you know, there's a definite sort of political element to this claim as well. And unfortunately for Brissendine, it's not really supported by the data, either sort of behavioral data or, you know, are women actually better at empathizing, or certainly not by the neuroimaging data that she cites. So,
well, I do want to point out that you actually analyzed every single neuroscience study that she cited as proof of female superiority in that area, and you did not exactly find compelling evidence.
No, that's right. I went through, she has a chapter called Emotional Brain or something like that, a chapter on emotion, and I did look at all the neuroimaging data that she cited as support for that, and to give it a sort of an indication to readers of how inaccurate her use of the scientific literature is, I go through a couple of pages of her book, and how shall I put this? It doesn't fulfill the standards of scientific accuracy in representation of data that one would hope from someone with her kinds of qualifications. So, for example, some of the studies that she cites as evidence for women's sort of more empathic or sympathetic responses to other people's pain, she draws on a neuroimaging study of people who they compared neural activity when someone was either given an electric shock to their hand or they saw their partner having an electric shock applied to their hand. But unfortunately, that particular study only used female participants. Now, clearly, you can't make any
interesting
claims about differences between male and female brains on the basis of a neuroimaging study that only investigated brain activity in female brains. Now, there was that same group did do another similar study where they did include male participants, and that time they found a small sex difference, in that this time it wasn't a partner, it was a confederate, and the confederates had either behaved in a sort of likable or dislikable way. And they found male and female brain activity was similar so long as the confederate had been likable, but different in the male, apparently a less supposed sympathetic response when the confederate had behaved in a dislikable way. But there's a sort of carelessness to how the, I think that would be a generous way of describing it, to how Luann Brissendine uses the data, that I think actually reflects in a more general way on our casualness about this topic, because the sorts of claims that Luann Brissendine has made, you know, certainly in relation to her book The Female Brain, has often been sort of uncritically reproduced or represented in newspapers and so on. And I think if people were making similar kinds of claims about differences between, you know, black and white brains, for example, people might, you know, journalists might feel, oh, gosh, let's just fact-check this before we send it out. And that doesn't happen when it comes to claims about differences between male and female brains. You see claims that often come from popular books, popular writers, that are simply incorrect, but they're in there in the press, and nobody seems that worried about this kind of misinformation going out there.
And we have a question from the chat room.
Is there any way at all that men are more X and women are more Y? Or do the bell curves just overlap too much for it to be statistically significant? And that's from Bytor.
Well, that raises a very important point about how we tend to think about sex differences, which is something that psychologists in this area just feel like they want to die of boredom because they say it over and over again, you know, which is that variability within sex is much greater than differences between sexes. And of course, often there are assumed to be differences between the sexes that in fact either don't exist or are actually surprisingly sensitive to the context in which something has been done. But just to touch on that point again of the overlapping curves, I think that's a really important point, because I think the way we talk about gender differences, and in particular talking about boy brains and girl brains, in a sense, I don't think there's anyone on the planet who doesn't realize or hasn't noticed the extraordinary variability of humans and what they are and what they can do, and nobody thinks that all boys are like this and all girls are like this, or recognize in some sense that of course there are overlaps in abilities and predispositions and personalities and so on and so forth. But when you start talking about boy brains and girl brains, it very much primes people to see males and females and categorize them in this very kind of crude caricature of maleness and femaleness. And I've recently moved to the Melbourne Business School, and of course a lot of the interest there is on this idea that what can women leaders bring to business, and there's this real push to draw on pseudoscience basically to say, well look, women have these special abilities because of these differences in their brains, and they can, you know, they bring a broader brush scope, for example, they're not so tied down, they're more intuitive, they have these benefits, so on and so forth. Now, apart from the fact that neuroscience doesn't show the brain differences that are claimed, and also even if they did, we have actually no scientific reason to think that they would be related to a different way of thinking in males and females. So, you know, scientifically, this is just nonsense. But I think it very much encourages people in business to see, well, women leaders are like this and male leaders are like this. And it actually discourages people from seeing leaders as leaders with their own particular very idiosyncratic strengths and weaknesses that are actually very poorly predicted by the sex that the person happens to be. So I think this notion of overlapping bell curves is absolutely extremely important. But at the same time, I think it's even that doesn't go quite far enough. So if you to come back to the point about Diane Bizendine, her claim is that women are more empathic, and people just believe that this is fact. And it's true that if you ask women, well, how good are you at working out what someone's feeling or thinking, then yes, they will come out ahead on those self-report questionnaires. But it turns out that how good people think they are at inferring other people's thoughts and feelings bears little or no relationship to how good they actually are. So you have this whole group of people who think they're, you know, superbly socially sensitive, and they go through life sort of trampling on people's feelings and not realizing what they're actually thinking. And so when you give men and women an actual performance test of empathic ability, so you put them in a room with someone, they don't realize it, but they're being secretly recorded, and then afterwards they're shown the videotape and they're asked, well, what was the person thinking there? What were they thinking there? What were they thinking there? You actually find that men and women perform identically on this test. It's been shown in numerous studies. The exception being that if you somehow highlight the social norm that women should be more sensitive, and then women do indeed perform a bit better, but that seems to be because they feel a kind of motivation because of this social norm to perform a bit better. So as well as sort of acknowledging the massive overlap between males and females, we also need to be careful about not assuming that perhaps that difference that you assume is there may not actually be present when you test for it properly.
So when we do hear about some new study that tells us that boys are innately like this and girls are innately like that, what are some things that lay people can look for that would tell us that maybe we should be skeptical?
Well, if you're talking about a neuroimaging study, a really important point to remember is that a lot of these findings will never be replicated, especially if they're based on small samples. But, you know, generally there is variability in these data. And what you can be sure of is that when the study isn't replicated, you will not read about it in the newspaper. I personally think it would be wonderful if meta-analyses were given more press attention in the science media. I think it's really interesting that individually studies can show that males are more lateralized for language, but that overall the consistent picture is no, actually there is no sex difference in how the brain is organized, those things. So one thing for people to bear in mind is one-off study, it may not be replicated. I mean, science is probabilistic. A second point is that in the brain doesn't mean innate. So our brains develop in constant interaction with our environments. There isn't just some sort of genetic blueprint that just then gets built on through some pre-specified code. So just because you see a sex difference in the brain doesn't mean that it must be hardwired. It could be, you know, where else would the effects of gender socialization manifest themselves? But the third point is really, we're so early on in our journey of understanding how neural circuits enable complex psychological phenomena that we don't really know at this point. When we have a neuroimaging finding or pattern of brain activity or a structural difference, what does that mean for cognition? It actually might, one possibility that rarely gets considered is that it might not mean anything. The brain has more than one means, there's more than one road to Rome. But we also, we need to be very cautious about making assumptions about what they might mean. You know, even if women were less lateralized for language, would that mean that they were better at language? Well, people have assumed that for decades. No one's actually tested the idea. So we need to be very careful. As Anne Fausto-Stirling pointed out, the brain is a vast unknown, and it's very, because it's so complex, it's very easy for us to sort of project our assumptions about gender onto these very complex, ambiguous data. And we just need to look to the past to see how dangerous that can be and how harmful for progress towards sex equality, because these ideas about male and female brains are very much part of the cultural lore, and they interact with our minds. They reinforce stereotypes and they create self-fulfilling prophecies.
You can find out more about Cordelia at cordeliafine.com.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
We're here with science writer Kathleen Taylor, author of the book Cruelty, Human Evil and the Human Brain. So you say your book sets out to provide preliminary groundwork for the development of a scientific theory about cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, neuroscience I can understand, and psychology, of course, but some people consider morality subjective. So can science actually tell us about morals?
Yes, I think it can. In fact, it's one of the very hottest areas of recent neuroscience at the moment is neuroscience and psychology of morality. There's a lot of evidence now that although morality may appear entirely subjective, it's not. It's constrained. And it's constrained by what seem to be pretty universal patterns all the way across. So if you look in different cultures, for example, different nations or races, what you find is that although the specific content of the moral rule may vary up to a point, so for example, some people think that kissing in public is disgusting and an abomination, whereas other people think it's fine. So the specific content varies from culture to culture, but the pattern of behaviours, the idea that some things are abominations and some things aren't, some things are permissible and some things aren't, the difference between moral rules, which you do not break because they are wrong, versus conventional rules, which you do not break because it's easier to follow them. All these sort of structural differences seem to be the same in every culture that people have looked at. And so what that tells you is that morality may be a little bit more like language. The specific languages differ from culture to culture, but the way languages are built up and structured seems to be much the same. And the same has been suggested to be true of morality. Now, whether or not you go as far as that, it does seem that morality is constrained by a whole lot of things that we wouldn't expect it to be constrained by if it were purely subjective.
Well, you say that cruelty is a response to threats.
Largely, yes.
What kind of threats?
So cruelty is a threat response, but it's one that's, if you like, overactive. It's just hyper-response. The response varies depending on what the threat is. The threat can be, for example, a threat to your existence. So you may be afraid that you or your culture or your people are going to be absolutely wiped out, in which case you're going to respond with a huge amount of fear and you're going to lash out very violently and aggressively. And perhaps because we're not that good at calibrating our responses, you're going to go too far and other people are going to turn around and say, "Ooh, that was cruel." So that's one type of response. But there are other responses to other kinds of threats. So, for example, something might make you really angry and you might say something really nasty because you've just been irritated. So depending on what emotions you're considering or you're stirring up, you can actually start breaking cruelty down into these different components. So instead of just thinking of it as, oh, yuck, that's evil, take it apart and start to understand that different threats, different emotional responses may produce different kinds of cruelties. And that's crucial because if you're trying to prevent the kind of cruelty that is based on fear, you're going to have to do it in a very different way than if you're trying to prevent the kind of cruelty that's based on disgust.
So where does empathy come into play here? It seems like just the empathy switch is at some point turned off.
Yes, I mean, that certainly seems to be the impression. I mean, there's preliminary evidence from, for example, functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, that we actually do have something like a kind of empathy dimmer switch that we can modulate up or down. Empathy, however, is a little bit of a double-edged sword, because if you empathize with someone and you see someone in distress, then obviously that will stimulate helping behavior and you'll want to look after that person. But if you empathize with them too much, you can start to feel so distressed yourself that instead of wanting to help the person, you just want to push the painful stimulus away and just blank it out. So empathy is fine, but too much empathy can actually drive you, if you like, to be more cruel, because you're wanting to get rid of the painful stimulus because it's so distressing.
So is empathy reliant on seeing people as somewhat like yourself?
Yes. I mean, that seems to be what people think. Certainly, if you look at the science and the networks, if you like, that seem to, quote-unquote, light up when you're looking at imaging of people who are empathizing, they have much in common with the networks that light up when people are thinking about themselves. So, I mean, putting it very crudely, it seems that what we're doing is judging people as more or less like us, more or less similar, and that we can then, by focusing on different aspects of the other person, for example, you can then modulate that and make people feel less similar. So this is where things like stereotyping and verbal abuse, all that sort of thing, all those steps, if you like, on the path to otherization, they all change the amount of similarity. So, for example, if you're invoking stereotypes, you're seeing people as simpler. And obviously, if they're simpler, because they're just a caricature, just a stereotype, rather than a fully rounded person. Well, you know, you're a fully rounded person because you have experience of your own inner life. So therefore, a stereotype is less like you.
You mentioned how activating part of a neural pattern increases the likelihood of activating all of it. How does that relate?
Well, that relates to cruelty when you come to look at extreme cruelty. On the premise of modern neuroscience, which is that every thought, idea, concept, behavior pattern, whatever, all of that is actually instantiated in some way, represented by the activity of clusters, groups, clumps, call them what you will, of neurons. And that those dynamic patterns of activity, which are constantly changing, those actually instantiate, if you like, and govern our behavior. So you've got this idea of patterns, and then you have ideas of a pattern being a group of neurons that's active at a particular time. Some or all of that group might be active. So you can trigger part of that, and then generally it will tend to flow through the whole. So you have this idea of partial activation, complete activation, and then on top of that, you have the idea that similar things have similar patterns. Okay, so in the visual cortex, for example, you might see activation in very similar areas. If you're showing a square and a diamond in the same area of the visual field, you're going to get similar patterns coming in and similar patterns in the brain reflecting that. And what that means is that those patterns will overlap. They'll use some of the same neurons. So if you imagine thinking about a particular behavior versus actually doing the behavior, you're going to use overlapping networks there. You're going to use many of the same neurons are going to light up or be active or whatever you want to call it when you're imagining the behavior as when you're actually doing this. And there have been numerous studies using fMRI showing that some of the same areas light up when you're imagining a movement or imagining a picture as when you're actually looking at it. It's not altogether the same, but they're similar. They're overlapping. And so what that tells you is that when you're thinking about doing something but not actually doing it, you're actually using those networks and reinforcing those patterns, because remember, every time you think about something, you're sending energy, if you like, through that network, and that is slightly strengthening that network, which means that it's much more likely to spring to mind next time. So you're reinforcing, building up the strengths of these networks over and over again every time you think about something. Now, obviously, you reinforce it much more when you actually do it and get rewarded. If you do it and get punished, then obviously you damp things down and you're less likely to choose that particular behavior in the future. But if you're rewarded by actually doing it, or if you're rewarded by just thinking about it, or if you talk about it with your friends and they reward you, they show approval and everything, that's going to be strengthening that and making it that little bit more likely that when it comes to the behavior, because you've, if you like, modeled that behavior to yourself, you've thought about it and imagined what it would be like, that possibility becomes part of your possibilities, your conceptual space. And it's something you're a little bit more likely to actually do than if you'd never thought about it until you're actually confronted with the choice, do I do this or not?
I really hate to bring this up because I know my audience, but how does this relate to video games then?
Oh, the long-running controversy about whether video games are bad for you morally or not. I must admit, this is probably something I shouldn't say, but, you know, there's so much real, live, actual horror and cruelty. I know, I've just spent 4 years writing about it. There's so much of that that's actually in the world. I find it hard to get worked up about whether people are playing Grand Theft Auto or not, to be honest. I think it's a fairly minor problem. We have got lots of other ways of socializing people into accepting violence. So I think if you play video games obsessively and you get rewarded for killing people in those games, then yes, it's probably not a good idea. There's some evidence that it's going to make you a little more aggressive and perhaps predispose you a little bit towards violence. But it's not going to have half the effect of sticking you in a group of people around you who are keen on violence or watching violent movies or hearing violence reported in the news. I mean, we have loads of opportunities to model violence in society because we talk about it all the time. We see it in our films, we see it on the television, we see it in the newspapers, we hear people talk about it, we read about it in books and novels. I mean, it's part of all our conceptual space. So I think the idea that video games, well, yeah, sure, they may contribute a little, but, I mean, there are lots of other contributions to this and a lot of evidence that people will still go and do this in the circumstances. So I would concentrate on changing the circumstances rather than worrying about the video games, to be honest. That's probably a really unfashionable thing to say. I'm sorry.
No, I would say that you've made several members of my audience very, very happy.
Oh, good.
So do you think that everyone, you know, in the right conditions and with the right stimuli, has the propensity for extreme cruelty?
I think that everyone has the propensity to be cruel. I think that most people, this is always about statistics and probabilities, never certainty, there's no certainty here. So not everyone, but most people put in that situation would be capable of extreme cruelty. Now, they might not to be extreme cruelty because they might think they were doing it in self-defense. But if you took them out of that situation and asked them as an impartial observer, they would say that was cruel. So I think most people are capable of it, absolutely.
So what exactly can we do about that?
Well, what we can do is learn what situations to look for as the danger signals, what to avoid. We can boost, for example, our reluctance to go to war, because the war is one of the biggest single determinants of this kind of cruelty. And there are a whole lot of reasons why that is, but part of it is that war brings its own set of justifications. So one of the things we can do is start to make those justifications less acceptable. Get rid of all the, you know, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori rubbish. Get rid of all this stuff. Get rid of the idea that a war can be just and justified on the kinds of shaky grounds that recent wars have been justified. So we can do all of that. We can boost, for example, ideas about human life being important, whatever it is. We can challenge negative stereotypes where we see them. We can look out for the kind of language of disgust, that kind of otherizing language, and we can challenge that when we see it. So, for example, in Britain today, it's not socially, politically acceptable to use blatant language of disgust in the way that it would have been, say, 60, 70 years ago. So if somebody were to stand up, a political leader were to stand up in Britain and say, these people are a cancer and they must be wiped out, you just couldn't do that. I mean, you would just get absolutely destroyed in the media if you did that. what you get then, of course, is the recourse to more subtle language. But nonetheless, that kind of extreme disgust language is now less acceptable than it was. And so by challenging that, by querying that, by standing up to the stereotypes, you can start to reduce the levels of cruelty. You can also, as I say, avoid the situations that we know give rise to it. So, for example, in the American War on Terror, and every social psychologist, I'm sure, who looks at this kind of field, predicted Abu Ghraib. Not in detail, but we knew something like that was going to happen. Why? Because it always happens. And all this rubbish about it being just a few bad apples. Nonsense. The situation demanded that kind of response from people, and people gave it. So if you put people into a situation where they are under severe threat, and they are also given a lot of power over people that they have been taught to demonize and otherize to an extreme extent, and then you wonder why you're going to get extreme cruelty coming out. Well, I mean, for heaven's sake, it's not a surprise. So there is all this information out there. There is a lot of knowledge already about what gives rise to cruelty. And so I think if we know, for example, that every war we fight, our soldiers are going to commit atrocities, it might make us think a little bit more about starting that war, sending people off. It might make us give our soldiers better training. It might make us cut down the level of otherization that we use in the run-up to war. So all of those things can be shifted and changed and modified just to try and actually cut down the justifications which give rise to cruelty.
Kathleen, that was very thought-provoking and still extremely depressing. You can find Kathleen at taylorsciencewriter.com. And from there, you can find links to her blog and to her books. And again, really fantastic books, just don't read it all at once.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're talking about what may be the most stigmatized facet of human reproduction. We're joined by Dr. Kate Clancy, anthropology professor and science blogger, to learn about the physiology and function of menstruation and the history of how it's been considered in medicine and myth. And biologist P.Z. Myers looks at menstruation from an evolutionary perspective. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders. I'm here with Ingrid Wickelgren. Ingrid solicits, writes, and edits feature articles and other content for Scientific American Mind. Her past work includes serving as a contributing correspondent for Science magazine and a freelancer for national publications, including Health, Popular Science, Business Week, and the New York Times. Her blog, Streams of Consciousness, appears on the Scientific American Blog Network. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Ingrid.
Thank you, Rochelle. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're here today to talk about the article Wired for Weird that appears in the January-February issue of Scientific American Mind. So first off, tell us why you wanted to include this piece in this issue.
Well, I think almost everyone has encountered paranormal beliefs, either has them themselves or other people comment or say that they, you know, see ghosts or they can predict the future or read someone else's mind. It's a very common phenomenon, but I think it's also something that engenders strong emotions and convictions. So people don't just say, oh yeah, you know, I think I can do this or I think I have this power. They seem incredibly convinced. And for people who maybe are a little bit skeptical of these things, so we think this couldn't really make sense. So why do they believe that? And this, you know, article kind of answers that question.
I found the statistics that you start off really interesting. They show that belief in things that we might call supernatural or paranormal is actually really common, right?
Yes, it's incredibly common. And I think that kind of speaks to, you know, your first question as well. 3 out of 4 Americans believe in the existence of paranormal phenomena. And 1 in 3 of us claim to have experienced the supernatural.
And when we say paranormal, just to be clear, what kinds of things are we talking about?
So there are a variety of paranormal phenomena. These phenomena include mental telepathy, sort of mind reading, clairvoyance. And clairvoyance is sort of a broad phenomena that can also include something called precognition or foreknowledge of the future. Another type of paranormal capacity is sort of controlling matter with your mind. and the ability to commune with the dead.
So scientists have been trying to find evidence for the existence of a lot of these kinds of things that you're talking about for a really long time. But so far, they've pretty much come up empty, haven't they?
Yes, they have. And it has been a long research process. Really, the scientific study of the paranormal dates back to the 1930s, when this parapsychologist from Duke named Joseph Banks Rhine decided to try to figure out whether people could psychically deduce the order of a shuffled deck of cards. He spent about 40 years trying to gain evidence for this phenomenon, and he found some promising results, but then, of course, they couldn't be replicated. And that has essentially been the story for all future attempts to replicate paranormal phenomena.
But the article mentions that failed replications often have a difficult time getting published. Does that make the literature look a little bit skewed in the end?
Oh, yes, I'm sure it does. And this is sort of a general problem, I think, for lots of areas of science, really. You know, people love to hear about new findings, right? We found something, yay. But then it's sort of deflating to then say, well, you know, we didn't find something. It just doesn't make for a very good journal article, a very interesting journal article. And I think it does skew people's impression of the truth.
The really interesting research has been looking into why these beliefs are so widespread. And it turns out that the ways our brains work actually kind of predispose us to believing. So let's talk a little bit about how memory can make us think that two unrelated phenomena are actually connected.
I sort of think that what the brain is doing is actually trying to make connections in the world, to find cause and effect, because this is a very adaptive phenomena. So if I fail to make the connection that the reason that my finger hurts so much is because I put it over a flame, then I'm going to do it again and I'm going to burn my finger and it's not going to be good. So the capacity of our brains to make these connections and to make these associations and to look for them in the world is very adaptive. So what happens is that I think we tend to remember the things that are consistent with the hypotheses that we generate for cause and effect. For example, if you sort of have a sense that maybe your dreams are telling you something, right? And maybe they're telling you something about the future, you might then be predisposed to remember the dreams that sort of conform with that hypothesis. And indeed, that's what research has shown. What happens is that we selectively remember the things that are consistent with these beliefs, and then we say, oh, we've got data. When really, if you actually look at all the number of dreams that we have by chance, yeah, some of them will happen to coincide with future events, but most of them probably do not. But if we remember the ones that do, then we think, oh, I can see the future in my dreams. When really it's just chance that some of them happen to be like what something that's going to happen later.
It sounds like another thing our brains are always on the lookout for is something called agency. Can you tell us what that means?
Agency means that we think that events are always caused by something or someone. They sort of happen on purpose rather than being at random or happening by chance.
And our brains then tend to basically assume that everything that happens is caused by an agent, doesn't it?
Yes. And this actually comes from another important piece of psychological hardware, the sort of the ability to read intentions of others and interpret those intentions. It's something called theory of mind, and it's very important for developing social relationships. Autistic individuals often have trouble reading other people's beliefs and intentions. So they are impaired in a lot of their social skills. That's kind of where it comes from. So there's a lot of another example of where there's sort of an adaptive quality for all of us that may also cause us to kind of assume intention where none exists.
So this is kind of a side effect of something that we've evolved for a very good reason as social creatures.
definitely. I think these social skills will then sort of, you know, a lot of these same feelings and abilities, you know, may sort of go into overdrive. And we then sometimes use them in situations in which maybe they don't apply perfectly.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders, here today with Ingrid Wickelgren, editor at Scientific American Mind, talking about how our brains predispose us in believing in the paranormal. The last piece of the cognitive puzzle here is the phenomenon called pareidolia. Can you explain that for us?
Pareidolia comes from the human capacity to recognize faces. And what it is the tendency to see faces and objects that don't really have faces. So we may perceive the pattern of a face in a piece of toast, or we may see that the front of a car looks like it's smiling at us. And that sort of ability to see faces everywhere is the phenomenon of pareidolia. And, you know, there's actually a section of the brain called the fusiform face area that's scientists think is specifically designed as a sort of a facial recognition center. And there's some data that it also gets activated when we see faces in objects.
Now, all of this is really a result of the fact that our brains are really good, maybe a little too good, at recognizing patterns, to the point where we often see patterns that aren't actually there. And it turns out there are evolutionary reasons why it might be better to err that way, correct?
Obviously, being able to recognize people you know to see that facial pattern, or being able to recognize that a predator is approaching, so you see, you know, a pattern you recognize as a face of a lion, you know, I don't know, if you're in the wild or something. it's obviously a good idea to recognize that pattern and have it be associated with danger or with help. And of course, you know, the association that I suggested earlier, you know, not being able to know that it was holding my finger above the flame that caused the pain, or, for example, that, you know, after I felt sick, after eating some food that had been left out on the counter for a day, not being able to make the association between my sickness and that behavior would definitely not aid in my survival. You know, I do think, though, that when this kind of sort of extends to paranormal associations, I just wonder if, I mean, because not all of us do decide that pattern that we see in the dark is actually a ghost. And I think the reason that a lot of us are skeptical of that sort of conclusion is that there's a part of our brain that says, wait a minute, does that really make sense? You know, there are other explanations. So we sort of inhibit that initial interpretation and think about others. And whether that's something that some of us are born to do, or whether that has to do with upbringing, whether parents, you know, talk to us when we're little and sort of discourage the paranormal or mystical interpretation of events, you know, I'm not sure the exact cause, but I suspect that it probably is a little bit of both.
And the extent to which individuals are influenced by these cognitive biases may actually have something to do with the way their brains distribute tasks between the hemispheres?
Right. So there is a little bit of data that sort of suggests that these crude differences in brain structure may influence a predisposition to belief in the paranormal. So we all know about right brain, left brain. The right brain folks sort of excel at recognizing faces, certain aspects of creativity, visual imagery, music. Left brain people are more facile with language, math, logic. Now, bear in mind that these distinctions are not really strict. So everybody uses both halves of their brains, but there are some ways to test whether you favor one side of your brain or the other. And using those types of experiments, there have been some associations with people who tend to be more right-brained and believe in the paranormal.
Well, Ingrid, it has been fantastic having you here today. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You'll find links to Scientific American Mind and Ingrid Wickelgren's blog, Streams of Consciousness, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.